Hi everyone, David here. Thank you so much for listening to What Matters. We hope you enjoy the show. Before we begin, if you and maybe some of your colleagues would like premium access to the What Matters podcast and want to read or listen to the essential in-depth journalism from Foresight Climate and Energy, make sure to subscribe. You can try us for 30 days for less than €1 a day, which will give you access to our website and app. Just follow the link in the show notes or go to www.foresightdk.com/subscribe to find out more. Hello and welcome to episode 15 of What Matters, the podcast from Foresight Climate and Energy. My name is David Weston and with me is Jan Rosenau of the Regulatory Assistance Project. Hi Jan, how are you? Last episode I said you were sunning yourself in the south of France, but you are actually at an energy efficiency conference there. Can you tell us a little bit about it?
Hi Dave, yes, that was an amazing conference. We had 400 people from all over Europe and a few Americans as well and Australians. And we met at the Côte d'Azur, at the southern coast of France in the Mediterranean Sea. And it was really the first big conference that I attended since the pandemic began in 2000. And just seeing everybody in such a, an amazing location and talking about energy was really energizing and really enjoyable. So it was just feeling like we are actually making progress, meeting like-minded people, and things are happening. So it was very inspirational, and I can't wait for the next one, which will take place in a couple of years. It's the ECEEE conference, which is the European Council for an Energy Efficient Economy.
Right. Absolutely. Really interesting. Yeah, well, obviously, we were at the IEA Energy Efficiency Conference at the same time. And again, I think that chimes much with the same of your assessment. It was really nice to be in a room of people with like-minded people and discussing ideas. And there was a nice buzz about the place. I was also at the Power Summit, the Eurelectric Power Summit in Brussels. And that, again, had the same sort of vibe. Everyone was very excited to be back in the same room together. And I think lots of ideas were sparking as a result. So yeah, really exciting times. Sadly, Michaela isn't feeling too well, so won't be joining us today, but we wish her a speedy recovery and hope she'll be back with us next time. This week, our guest is Jesse Jenkins, an assistant professor at Princeton University with a joint appointment in the Department of Mechanical and Aerospace Engineering and the Andlinger Center for Energy and Environment. Jesse also leads the Princeton Zero Lab, a zero carbon energy systems research and optimization laboratory, which conducts research to improve decision making, to accelerate rapid, affordable, and effective transitions to net zero carbon energy systems. Jesse, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks. Appreciate the opportunity to join you.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for joining us. It's great to have you. And we have so much we want to discuss, from the current energy crisis in Europe to whole energy systems thinking. But let's start with your home country of America. And how has energy policy changed since President Trump and since Joe Biden's come into office? Is there now renewed momentum if now there is a government that is more sympathetic to climate change?
Well, it's certainly been a marked difference with the change in administrations and the inauguration of the 117th Congress, with the barest of majorities for the Democratic Party, which is unfortunately the only one of the two parties in the United States that seems to have any motivation to confront the climate crisis. The ambitions of the Biden administration were significant and, announced right away as the administration took office, including a renewed commitment to the Paris Agreement, a new nationally determined contribution to reduce emissions to half of our peak levels, which occurred in 2005, by 2030, and a government commitment to net zero greenhouse gas emissions by 2050. Now, of course, those are commitments and they need to be backed up by policy. And that's where things are a bit more challenging, as always. There are a number of steps that the administration has taken within its executive authority, including leveraging government procurement, embedding climate policy into trade agreements, including a notable deal with the European Union on trade in steel and aluminum that will help usher in, I think, the first low carbon buyers block to try to unify countries that have a lower emissions intensity and to trade preferentially amongst themselves. And a set of regulatory measures, probably most notably so far, the improvements in fuel economy standards for vehicles, which have been announced for the next few years. And then they're working on more aggressive standards that will come for, I think, 2027 through 2030 model years. Now, in Congress, the efforts to pass policies to improve, you know, our energy system and accelerate the transition are really embodied in two bills. We've launched a project here at Princeton in anticipation of the new Congress and administration called the REPEAT Project at repeatproject.org. That's for Rapid Energy Policy and Evaluation and Analysis Toolkit, with the goal of assessing these bills as they're evolving in Congress and trying to understand in as close to real time as possible what their impact on our energy transition is going to be. So that's been a really fun and illuminating project that's really provided a lot of insight to stakeholders, to policymakers, and to the media right as these debates are unfolding. And those two bills are really the bipartisan infrastructure bill, or now law, which passed in November. And has been now starting to, you know, have funding roll out through administrative programs to a variety of energy-related programs. That was mostly focused on longer-term technology-enabling policies. So there's a large investment, really historic investment, in energy R&D, and particularly demonstration and early deployment of more nascent technologies like hydrogen from a variety of sources. We're going to build several hydrogen hubs throughout the country that use different energy sources, blue hydrogen, green hydrogen, all the silly colors. You can come back to why I hate the colors later if you want to. But low carbon hydrogen from a variety of sources, carbon capture and storage, direct air capture, advanced geothermal energy, advanced energy storage. So a whole range of important enabling technologies that we'll need in the 2030s and 2040s to dive towards zero emissions. Now, where we're struggling right now is on all the things that are going to drive deployment of mature technologies, wind, solar, energy efficiency, electric vehicles, the kinds of things that can make a real dent in our greenhouse gas emissions over the next decade and help us ensure that we can meet that 50% reduction in emissions by 2030. And that is embodied, those measures are embodied in the party line budget reconciliation bill that the Congress has been working on for 2 years now, nearly 2 years. The House passed its version of the bill after some negotiations right around the same time they passed the infrastructure law last November. And according to our assessment, that bill would really do about 90% of what we need to do to reach our greenhouse gas reduction goals in 2030. It would buy us really an enormous decade of progress, driving large-scale deployment of wind and solar, really, you know, pushing even further over the tipping point towards electric vehicles, accelerating energy efficiency and home electrification, and other important measures. That bill is stalled in the Senate, where many things go to stall in the U.S. And where, for I'm sure some of our European listeners know this already, but we have a 50-50 split in the Senate right now, and most measures require 60 votes to overcome a filibuster. The bipartisan infrastructure law was able to do that with support from a dozen or so Republicans. But the budget bill is a party line effort. And so it needs all 50 Democratic votes to pass the bill, along with the vice president casting the tie-breaking vote. And so far, that's been elusive, with particularly West Virginia Senator Joe Manchin having a number of important demands that need to be worked out. The good news is that it seems over the last few weeks that those negotiations have been progressing between Senator Manchin and Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer. Very quiet talks. They're keeping the lid on much of it. And there's been very little leaked to the press about where things stand. But we are starting to hear that some of the major sticking points look like they're being resolved. Now, unfortunately, that means some concessions and further reductions in the impact of the bill relative to what the House passed. But I take that as a good sign that we're actually moving closer to final passage of a bill. That's really important because the game clock is winding down on this Congress. They break for recess maybe today or tomorrow for the 4th of July recess. Wow. And then they're really back in August. And that's, in the end of July, and then they're off again in August. And that's sort of the end of the timeline. So cool. We're down to the last wire, but progress is being made. And it looks like there's a chance a big bill could pass before the summer.
Absolutely.
The
end of the summer. And then you're into midterms and re-election campaigns.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
And then everything gets stalled. Sounds like similar difficulties in the sort of legislative arm of Europe as well, and how things are stalled in the European Parliament and the European Commission as well. So we've got a lot of experience of that. What are the major barriers then, other than political, to the United States sort of energy transition?
I really do think the biggest is, passing a policy that's going to align the financial incentives behind the energy transition. There's a lot of reasons to invest in clean energy and energy efficiency already. Those reasons are even more pronounced as we focus once again on energy security, and we see, natural gas and oil prices rising back towards record levels. That said, we do need, I think, national policy that's going to align the whole country behind the kinds of investments that we need to make at the pace that we need. We will make this energy transition. The question is, do we do it fast enough to meet emissions goals in 2030 and to reach net zero by 2050? And I think for that, we do need federal policy that can provide the tailwinds and, momentum that we need for the transition. If that falls into place, then the question is how quickly we can scale up supply chains and industries, train the workforce that we need, manage the political challenges of an energy transition that will, leave some incumbent communities and industries in decline and others growing. So how can we align those benefits and costs so that we can sustain the political momentum we need over the decades ahead? And I think perhaps the biggest one, which I think was a challenge in Europe as well, is just we have to build an enormous amount of infrastructure to accomplish this transition. We have to rebuild the entire modern energy infrastructure in less than three decades. It took us maybe 100, 150 years to build our current set of energy infrastructures. And so we're talking about dramatically accelerating the pace of infrastructure build out and turnover relative to what many of us, that grew up after the 1970s are used to. I mean, we built most of the modern infrastructure in the West in the post-war era, the 50s, 60s, 70s. And we've sort of been living off the fat of the land since then and, maybe maintaining the infrastructure, not so well in some cases, but not really building large scale infrastructure projects, right? We don't, when's the last time you saw a new highway go in or a new very large transmission, path? And yet that's exactly what we're going to have to do if we want to rebuild our energy infrastructure, build potentially triple the size of the U.S. transmission system by 2050, according to Princeton's Net Zero America study, build, 1 to 2 terawatts each of wind and solar across the country, and just develop and deploy a new national CO2 transport network and storage basins to capture CO2 and safely store it. So an enormous amount of infrastructure, and we're just not used to doing that. So building the social license and the kind of societal muscle memory again around, both accepting, but also guiding in a way that builds social license, that scale of infrastructure. I hope that's the challenge we're dealing with, because that means we're trying to go as fast as we can, and we're running into those kinds of challenges. So hopefully that's the kind of challenge that we can spend the next decade or two trying to overcome.
I know you've written extensively about zero emissions power systems. From your perspective, what are the key technological solutions needed for that to happen? Obviously, we spoke about a little bit about infrastructure and generation, wind and solar. And what are the key areas of maybe uncertainty in that area?
Yeah, so in our work, we've tried to introduce a new kind of taxonomy for the building blocks of a low carbon energy system or electricity system. And there are really three big tools or categories that we need to fill out. And within those, there's a few different options, but you need to cover all of those categories to really cost effectively and reliably decarbonize the grid. The first is where we have the sort of best progress recently, and that's in wind and solar power and other weather-dependent variable renewable energy sources, which we classify largely as fuel-saving energy resources. Because of their variability, at high penetration, the times when we need the most dependable capacity or the ability to, reliably generate power tends to occur exactly at the times when we don't have very much wind or solar power, right? At night, during a calm wind period, or over a multi-day periods when we have wind droughts, or as the Germans call it, Dunkelflaute. And so where we get the most value from wind and solar is not in necessarily shutting down reliable power plants, but in avoiding the need to burn expensive fuels and to emit the CO2 and other pollutants that go along with those fuels. And that is a lot of value. We get a huge amount of value from that, particularly with natural gas prices soaring and the need to cut emissions from coal and gas. And so that's largely where wind and solar deliver their value. Now, what that means is as we push more and more wind and solar into the system, they start to displace more and more of the fuel burning resources, and more of their output is concentrated because of the weather in times when we already have an abundance of wind and solar. And so their value in those time periods is fairly low. So we can do a lot with wind and solar. They're now the cheapest forms of electricity we can get in most of the world. And we can drive maybe half or more of the decarbonization we need with just growing those fuel saving resources. But that's not sufficient. We also need what we call fast burst or balancing resources, which are helpful to manage the variability on the kind of daily and intradaily time scale. So on hours and up to diurnal, overnight cycles. And that's where a battery energy storage plays a huge role. We've seen the cost of batteries plummet largely due to the large scale deployment in electric vehicles, which has driven a huge amount of cost reductions and innovation. And that means that we now have cost-effective grid-scale battery storage, which is really good at managing those sort of quick bursts of power. But like a sprinter versus a marathon runner, you don't want to depend on those batteries for long stretches. Demand flexibility is another option. We can, choose when we charge our electric vehicles, when we, fire up our hot water heaters. Again, good for, daily scale flexibility, but you're not going to want to stop charging your vehicle for 3 weeks, right, if you run into a prolonged, wind drought. So those are good for short bursts of energy or power. And what that leaves is the category that's currently dominated by our fossil fueled resources like natural gas and coal. And that's what we call firm resources or technologies that are available anytime you need them for as long as you need them. And so those are really important complements to the weather dependent variable resources like wind and solar or run river hydro, and the shorter, fast burst sprinters like batteries and demand flexibility. And so, again, today we rely primarily on our aging nuclear fleet and on gas and nuclear plants for that role. To get to a zero carbon or net zero carbon grid, we're going to have to switch out all of those fossil resources and replace any of the retiring nuclear power plants with new clean, firm resources or firm low carbon technologies. And there is where we probably need more innovation over the next decade. Not necessarily laboratory breakthroughs. We don't need fusion to come to market, in the next 5 years, although that would certainly be nice. But we do need to take technologies like advanced nuclear, advanced geothermal, carbon capture and storage, green or low carbon hydrogen combustion, bioenergy with carbon capture, all of those technologies, which we fundamentally know how to build, that we know the engineering principles and the science, but they're much less mature and higher risk than we would like them to be. Similar to where wind and solar were a decade or so ago, right? They're expensive alternative technologies in a nascent stage. And so like we supported wind and solar when they were expensive and drove their deployment and made them into mainstream cost-effective technologies, we have to repeat that kind of success with those firm low-carbon technologies over the next decade. If we do that, then in the 2030s and 2040s, we'll be really prepared to scale up those technologies and displace and get off of the remaining fossil plants that we are dependent on today.
What do you think is the sort of most promising low carbon firm generation out there?
It's hard to say, partly because, it's a big world and we have to decarbonize all of it. And there are, a lot of diverse constraints and preferences out there in the world. And so for certain parts of the world, like the American West, I'm very bullish on advanced geothermal energy. We've made a lot of progress in the U.S. on horizontal drilling and hydraulic stimulation of wells for the shale industry. That's now starting to spill over into the enhanced geothermal sector, where we have a number of companies, including one that we've done research with here at Princeton, Fervo Energy, are drilling and developing their first commercial projects that could, if they're successful at showing that they can produce artificial reservoirs and through hydraulic fracturing to extract heat from the ground at temperatures they need to, that could open up a terawatt scale resource in the Western United States and elsewhere in the world. That said, even there, you know, there's limits to where you'll be able to do hydraulic fracturing due to seismic risk. There's going to be, you know, limits to places where they don't have the thermal resource close to the surface, and they'll have to drill even deeper. You know, so there are other technologies like closed loop geothermal that Ever, which is a company I'm on the scientific advisory board for, is developing that could work in places where you don't need to do any, you don't have to do any hydraulic fracturing. You can do it right in the middle of a city, decarbonized district heating, or provide firm power. So, you know, there's a diversity of resources that are going to fit in different places. Some countries will probably turn to advanced nuclear, like, you know, Japan, which really lacks a whole lot of other options, you know, technologies that are safer and inherently reliable. And I think in some places like the U.S. South and, you know, the Texas Gulf Coast region and the Middle East, where we have an abundance of low-cost natural gas, we'll probably turn to carbon capture to convert those, you know, gas, to use that natural gas without contributing to greenhouse gas emissions. There's one particularly promising technology, the Alum-Fetvelt cycle that Net Power is developing, which is a basically zero emissions option for burning natural gas. It's an oxygen combustion. So they burn it in a pure oxygen environment. And that means that all the stuff that's in the atmosphere, like nitrogen that normally gets combusted alongside the gas, doesn't produce pollutants. So you get pure CO2 and water vapor out of the combustion process. And the trick for them, the main thing that makes that actually practical, there have been other attempts to do combustion with conventional power plants, but that takes up a lot of power to produce the pure oxygen in an air separating unit. And then the benefit of the alum cycle is it uses supercritical CO2 as the working fluid, which is a much higher efficiency cycle. And so they're able to get this boost in efficiency, which offsets the need to use energy to produce the oxygen for oxycombustion. And so again, you know, these are technologies that are being demonstrated, their first commercial projects in the next year, two, three, four. So we don't know ultimately which will succeed, which will be cost effective. But the good news is that there's a diversity of shots on goal, right? And I think that's the key for the next, you know, decade, is try as many of these technologies as possible, support them through that demonstration and early deployment stage. And if we do that, I think we'll see multiple clean firm resources emerge and complete the low carbon toolkit that we need to get to net zero emissions cost effectively quickly.
Jesse, you spoke a lot about the supply side of the transition and the need to build out infrastructure to essentially switch away from fossil combustion technologies to technologies that are zero carbon or very low carbon. And to what extent does the demand side play a role in your work, in your modeling? And by demand side, I mean not just reducing energy consumption through energy efficiency, but also flexibility, maybe distributed energy resources, you know, decentralized solar, for example, and small batteries. How does that sort of fit in to your modeling, and how important you think that piece is when you look at the overall portfolio of technologies?
Yeah, it's been a major focus of my research as well. I was a member of the MIT Utility of the Future study team, which took a big deep dive into the role of distributed energy and demand automation flexibility, and released a report in 2016 on the topic. And it was actually the focus of my dissertation research, was to figure out how to model these demand side and distributed resources in a large scale capacity planning model. So where we see two things. The first is, as you know, Jan, electrification is central to all of the economy-wide decarbonization pathways that we see. And so we need to be converting as much of the building, transportation, industrial demand as possible to electricity. That does two things. One, it makes most of those processes much more efficient. So the final energy conversion from energy fuel to, in this case, electricity, to energy service like heat or mobility is far more efficient for an electric vehicle than an internal combustion engine or a heat pump than a boiler. And so that means we don't need to generate as much electricity as you might think to convert over. And that saves a lot of primary energy in the end. And then the second thing it does, of course, is it takes us from a dependence on a single fossil fuel, typically, right? You know, petroleum-based fuels for transportation or natural gas or coal for heating. And it plugs us into a grid with a diversity of increasingly low carbon sources. And so in all of the, you know, studies we've seen from our group and many, many others, electrification is the, you know, flip side of the coin of electricity decarbonization. And together, those do maybe 70% of the work of decarbonizing the grid, you know, range, you know, 60 to 80% or something like that of decarbonizing, not just the grid, I should say, but the whole economy. You know, depends how far we can push electrification, you know, how quickly we can decarbonize the grid, but it's the critical linchpin in an economy-wide net zero plan. It also means we have to prepare for a lot of demand growth in the electricity sector, notwithstanding improvements in energy efficiency, which will also be progressing along the same time. And so while the economy as a whole, we see it consuming a lot less energy due to end-use efficiency and electrification, the power sector might need to prepare to more than double electricity demand by 2050. And that's really going to take off in a nonlinear way. Right. So the next decade might start to see an uptick in growth, but probably in our modeling around 2030, we see an inflection point where, you know, the uptick of EVs starts to roll along, the stock turnover starts to progress, you know, industry and buildings start to turn to electric heating. And all of a sudden, demand is going to be growing at a pace we have not seen in the West since, you know, since the 1960s and 70s. And so that's just a whole different paradigm to prepare for grid planning. And it means that all of that new demand growth needs to be as flexible as possible, or we're going to end up building in a large amount of infrastructure that we really use very infrequently. You know, distribution substations that are, you know, reinforced only for 10 hours of the year, you know, where we're at that peak demand, or batteries that are standing by just to help, you know, charge EVs on rapid chargers, right? That, you know, maybe don't need to do it at the same time, or, you know, maintaining gas fired power plants and infrastructure to act as backup for those systems. And since we already have to build an enormous amount of infrastructure, we really want to reduce that as much as possible and utilize the infrastructure we do build as much as possible. And so we see demand flexibility, you know, automated and smart EV charging, you know, using hot water tanks. I know there's a lot of tankless systems in Europe, and in the US, we have a lot of big insulated water tanks in our homes. It's a big thermal battery sitting in the basement of every building around.
We still have a few of those, but we've taken them out to save space, but there's still millions of them.
And you could now add thermal storage, ceramic, brick, you know, storage or other options to add to these systems and for both water and space heating. So there's a huge amount of demand flexibility we can unlock. And what we see in our modeling is that does two things. As I mentioned, it reduces the amount of infrastructure you have to build and improves its utilization. It also significantly reduces the amount of batteries we need, because demand flexibility, shifting and reducing consumption when prices are high, or shifting it around to optimize cost, it looks a lot like a battery from the grid's perspective. And so it plays that fast burst balancing role I talked about before very well. And we see direct substitution. The more demand flexibility or the less demand flexibility we have, the less or more batteries we need to build. And the better we utilize the ones that we do build. And so that's another big savings. We don't need quite as much grid storage as a lot of people think we do if we can unlock that demand flexibility.
I have a follow-up question on the flexibility point in particular, because technically in the models, you know, you can show the benefits of that. It's already possible today with existing technology to do all these things. In fact, you know, I'm doing that myself. I have a heat pump and an EV, and I run both devices, both assets, in a way that is grid friendly and, you know, minimizes carbon emissions and delivers cost savings at the same time to myself and to the system. But there's been a discussion in not just in Europe, I think also in some of the states in the US, about how ready the public is to participate in such flexibility, even if it is fully automized. You know, there certainly is some pretty negative and pessimistic press coverage at times, which basically says that it's only the wealthy who will kind of benefit from that, or people don't want others to interfere with their electricity usage. What do you make of sort of such skepticism and this pessimism, and how can we persuade the public at large to buy into this vision of a much more flexible demand side to support decarbonization and to support essentially what is a smaller energy system overall that's going to cost us less to run?
Well, so I'd say the first thing is that if we're going to do that, there are large savings to be had here, and those savings have to be shared in a motivating way with the flexible consumers. And so that requires innovative business models and often regulatory reform. At RAP, there's a significant need, particularly in the United States, for reforming mass market retail rate design to provide a lot more incentive to consume flexibility. Right now, we have in most of the country flat hourly volumetric rates that bundle in all of the costs of the grid, even those that are not driven by the volume you consume, like the how much grid capacity you need or how much generating capacity you need or policy costs that have to be collected regardless. Those all get rolled into a volumetric rate. That does two things. One, it impedes electrification because we pay much higher than the marginal cost in much of the country for electricity much of the time. Here in New Jersey, I'm, paying 16 to 20 cents per kilowatt hour on average. The wholesale price is often 3 to 4 cents or 6 cents if you add in some hedging costs and things like that. So I'm paying 2 to 3 times what the actual cost of charging my EV or, running my dishwasher actually is if I do it at the right times. Now there are times when it's higher than the average, but most of the time it's lower. In California, where they're paying 40 cents a kilowatt hour, it's almost always higher than it should be. And even after you account for social, costs that aren't priced into our market prices right now. So Severin Borenstein and Meredith Fowley and others at UC Berkeley have done some excellent work to show this. And so that can impede electrification, first of all, because it makes my gas boiler look artificially more competitive relative to switching to a heat pump or an electric vehicle. But the other thing the flat part of the rate does is it means there's really no value for me to operate flexibly. So I'm a grid nerd. I know that overnight, in New Jersey, the prices are much lower. I know that the emissions rates tend to be lower. So, I program my my dishwasher to run at night. But that's just a charitable contribution to the world. I don't get any incentive to do that. And the vast majority of people don't either. And so I think we need both mass market rate reform and the potential for new business models to come in and activate that potential, whether that's rewarding utilities to do it themselves, creating space for aggregators of retail demand flexibility to move into this space and offer products to consumers, or just providing the incentive to the consumer themselves and then let them figure out how they want to deal with it. And I think there's probably three classes of people out there, increasing size. One is, the folks who I think of, there are some people who like to get on Robinhood or E-Trade and day trade stocks, right? Because they really, love to optimize all of that themselves. But that's a very narrow sliver of people. And there are probably going to be some people like that too, that want to have the app on their phone that they directly control everything. I think that's the minority of people, but there are tools already today to do that effectively if you want to. The second category, I think, are going to turn things over to a third party to sort of manage it for them. And I think of that, like most of us, our retirement portfolios are managed by some, index fund or some money market fund or other, managed third party fund. And that's the same thing with, trying to save money on your energy bill. You're going to hand that over to an aggregator who's going to come in and provide you with a range of products and automate their control and aggregate them into markets to leverage a larger pool of customers and share that with you as in the form of a lower cost energy bill. And the final category might just be simply willing to hedge the cost and not think about it ever, right? You just pay a higher bill for a flat volumetric rate, if that's what you want, or a flat monthly bill, and then let the retailer manage that price exposure, either by directly mitigating the risk or by just financially hedging it. And if we can allow the customer base to sort of filter out into those segments, then we'll end up with a much more flexible grid. And you mentioned, maybe only wealthy people will choose to buy these devices or be motivated enough to jump in. I'm not so sure that's true. They do have more capital, but if you're relying on a third party option, lower income folks where electricity bills are a bigger chunk of their disposable income might actually be more motivated to do this. Wealthy people to be like, whatever, it's another $100. I don't really, care. But somebody who can save, $50 a month where that really matters to their budget will be more motivated. And so there could be a market for those third-party aggregators to come in and provide the capital and the equipment and share those savings with motivated customers. The last point I'll make on this is that even if not everyone participates, everyone benefits from efforts to improve the utilization of our grid and to lower the average energy cost. Because in New England, for example, where I spent 7 years at MIT and Harvard, 1% of hours of the year drive about 8% of the total cost of the grid, and 10% of ours drive about 40% of the cost, if I'm remembering my stats correctly. And so, you know, we have a disproportionate amount of cost borne in a few hours because that's when demand spikes. And so we build all this infrastructure that sits around and is poorly utilized. And if only those few price responsive, active, motivated customers drop their consumption during those hours, that lowers costs for everyone, not just for them, because the average price of, you know, the marginal price of electricity those hours plummets, the amount of rate-based transmission infrastructure we have to build starts to fall, distribution upgrades are smaller, and many of those costs are passed on to everyone, not just to the people consuming at the peak. So it's a win-win situation, but we do need to pursue it carefully and with an eye towards equity as well. If we're going to do any rate reform, we have to make sure that those reforms are progressive and don't disproportionately harm lower income customers. That's all possible too.
I think that time period that you mentioned, that 1% in Europe is often measured in the your halftime at the World Cup final. Yeah, that's when everybody takes a quick break, maybe turns the kettle on, and that's kind of where peak demand sits in Europe.
Yeah, we see that on Super Bowl Sunday here in the United States too.
Right. It's a good indicator for when demand is going to be high. I really like your point about low income customers and flexibility, because I fully agree with everything you said, Jesse. We're actually writing a report that has a working title, Fair Flex, which is about how do we make flexibility accessible to everybody, especially to our low income customers, because there's so much potential. If you lower bills, you know, provide them with the devices that they need, they don't need to interfere with the system at all. They just get lower bills. So there's a huge benefit in that. So yeah, very much support your kind of vision of how flexibility fits in to the wider energy system.
But then who's going to pay for that? All of these things come with a cost, and absolutely low income households should be supported. But who then pays for it? Is it the government? Is it the utility? Is it the product suppliers, the generators? Where should that money come from?
Hi everyone, David here again. Just a reminder that you and your colleagues can get premium access to the What Matters podcast and all of the in-depth journalism from Foresight Climate and Energy by subscribing. You can give us a try for 30 days for just €29, where you can access our website and audio app. Go to foresightdk.com/subscribe or follow the link in the show notes. Now back to our conversation.
Well, in many cases, there's a large amount of savings that's unlocked by those investments. And so over a period of time, particularly over the horizon that utilities typically think about and get their return on investment, there's more than enough savings to pay back the cost of that infrastructure and to share in the near term in particular those savings with the end use customer, with the lower income, moderate income customer. So, you know, we should be doing things that are cost effective, that save much more than the cost. And if that's the case, then there's money to spare there to compensate the utility or the third party aggregator for providing the capital and the customer for participating in the program. Now, they won't save as much on a monthly basis as if they put the capital up front, but they won't have to put any capital up front, so they're not paying back that opportunity cost. So the end use customer is still well off there in the sense that they're getting the savings stream net of the repayment of the capital. So there, you know, not every investment will pay off in that structure, but the most cost effective, the ones with the biggest savings would. And of course, that's where we should target our efforts first. And if, you know, there is a goal to combat energy poverty and to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, then this is a public good as well. And maybe there should be a portion of that cost that's covered by the general rate base or by the government, ideally, since taxes are much more progressive than retail rates and, you know, utility bills.
Absolutely. Joe Biden recently used the Defense Production Act to ramp up the production of heat pumps and solar panels as well. But on the heat pump side of things, you've mentioned heating before earlier in your answers. Are heat pumps going to have as big an impact in the US as they look set to have in Europe?
I hope so. We're definitely behind in the adoption rate, and there are less options available for large central heating systems that which we often have in U.S. homes than there are for sort of mini splits and ductless heating systems that predominate in Europe, as I understand it. But we are starting to see those markets ramp up. Again, it really depends on where you are in the country and how rates are structured for natural gas and for electricity, because that can really shift the economics of those two options. And, you know, in places, many places, we have the same incentives for an efficient gas boiler as we would for an efficient electric heat pump, you know, in terms of utility rebate programs and things like that. That's starting to shift. I think California is about to reprogram all of their energy efficiency funding towards electric options and away from gas options. But, you know, so it really depends where you are in the country, how the economics work. It's certainly further behind electric vehicles in terms of the apparent, you know, payback and economic value for U.S. consumers. But that is an area that we can, I think, tremendously accelerate, again, with the right kinds of policies, particularly the sorts of tax credits and incentives that are in the reconciliation budget bill that's, you know, I guess I mentioned being debated right now. If those pass and those credits become much more widely available and easily claimed, you know, through refundability or other measures that make those easier to claim for more customers or more people, then that could really accelerate heat pump adoption as well. Beyond that, I think it's really going to come down to state level policies who, you know, govern a lot of things like building codes and utility rebates and incentive programs and rate design to encourage adoption of home heating electrification and industrial heating electrification too, which is another big potential option. So I'd say, you know, heat pumps, when we do the modeling, are always a big piece of it. I'm more concerned about falling behind the pace of adoption we see in our modeling for heat pumps than I am for electric vehicles, which I think are progressing quite rapidly, probably more rapidly than I anticipated and many others. So that is where we probably need more of a policy and regulatory push, is on building electrification. And I would say that while a lot of states, you know, the majority of states have some kind of focus on renewable electricity or clean electricity, a good number of them, about a third, have zero emissions vehicles policies modeled after California. Very few states have a good comprehensive building electrification strategy and policy in place. And so it is an area where we need to learn a lot, maybe from Europe. I know the Netherlands and other countries really pushed in this direction recently. And where I've been having discussions with New Jersey policymakers and others to, you know, try to figure out, some states are going to need to pioneer successful policy and regulatory models and then hope that those replicate quickly the way we've seen for, you know, other key policy areas like renewable portfolio standards or model building codes or other kinds of things.
I mean, the Netherlands are a really interesting case. I calculated about 4% last year of all homes in the Netherlands have install a heat pump in one single year, which is extraordinary, really. That is unheard of. That pace of adoption is, I think, only the Nordic countries, Finland, Norway, you know, they can kind of show similar installation rates. But it's the Netherlands, which is basically 90%, you know, natural gas for central heating. So the transition happens very quickly suddenly, because they have the kinds of regulations that you talk about that need to be implemented to really drive the market. I mean, my sense has always been just having incentives is not enough to get that market to scale. I think EVs are a bit different, you know, it's aspirational. They actually offer a better driving experience. And they people can touch them, see them. A heat pump isn't quite the same category, I guess, like a Tesla, you know, a nice electric pickup truck or something like that. It's just more invisible and just provides the same service as your previous heating system. I actually have a connected question to, may.
I was hoping I could return that, ask you a question, you know, give us a sketch of what the key policies are in the Netherlands so that Americans can try to pursue those as well.
Well, it's a combination, really. I mean, in the Netherlands, because of the earthquakes that have been experienced due to the exploitation of gas, there has been an announcement to phase out gas in heating, you know, no more connections of new buildings to the gas grid. But also now there's been a policy announcement made that by 2026, you can no longer install a standalone fossil fuel heating system. So you need to have either a hybrid system that could be a heat pump coupled with a gas furnace, a gas boiler, or it could be a heat pump just standalone. So that's sort of, you know, a hard regulatory measure to basically stop the sales of fossil heating systems. But there are also generous subsidies for it. And what you mentioned earlier, Jesse, the way how we tax energy and how we put policy costs on electricity, the Netherlands have started to shift that. They understand that, you know, there needs to be the right incentives in place on the running costs to make sure people actually switch from fossil heating to clean heating. So those are the kind of key policies that the Netherlands have introduced. I think we should have a whole episode on that, maybe, David, at some point, and talk about the Netherlands and how they've done it, because it's such a fascinating case study, I think.
I'd love to listen to that. Thanks.
I had a follow. Actually, it's a connected question, but yeah, I think it was in February last year, if my memory is correct, that we had this massive energy crisis in Texas, and you, Jesse, were one of the people who all the journalists, I think, followed on Twitter. What's the latest on Texas? Like, what's happened? Yeah, where do we have the latest outages and what's happening in the markets, and you know, what's the reason for it? And I think your following kind of exponentially expanded because you were providing them with that information. I mean, could you maybe say a few words about Texas, kind of reflecting back on it, kind of what drove it? You know, heat pumps were mentioned as a potential solution, and you know, poor efficiency electric heating systems were mentioned as part of the problem, which is why I thought about Texas. But I'm just curious to see, you know, like we're like a year and a bit on, how do you see it? What was the main reason for what we've seen in Texas? Is it that was renewables, which some people say were to blame? Is it frozen up, you know, gas generation? What was going on in Texas, basically? I mean, it's a complex It's a complex picture, but if you could just try to summarize what you think went wrong and going forward, what Texas is doing to prevent that from happening again.
Yeah, so I think at its base, it's a good example of the kind of correlated failures and crises that we need to be more prepared for than we are. When we often do power system planning, the assumption is that the outage rates for, you know, firm or reliable power plants are independent. Right, there's a chance that something breaks, and maybe there's a 5 or 6% chance at any time that your, you know, plant, some of your thermal plants fail, and then the wind and solar are variable, and then, you know, sort of do their own thing, and you have to plan around that variability, and demand is variable, and that you do, you know, that's sort of separate. But the reality is that those are all correlated through weather, through critical infrastructure like natural gas delivery. And so what happened in this case is a unusual cold snap, not a totally unprecedented one. Actually, when there was a previous example in, I think, 2011, and another one maybe a decade before that as well, that also caused some amount of demand shedding. And I, you know, after the crisis, I picked up the North American Energy Electricity Reliability Council's reports on the aftermath of those crises, and they read like they could have been written about the February 2021 crisis as well. And so, you know, not a lot changed, unfortunately, between those. But what basically happened is it got very cold, not just in part of Texas, but really across the entirety of the state, all the way down into the demand centers along the Gulf Coast region. And so you had a series of failures that were all correlated through those very cold temperatures. The first, you already mentioned the role of energy efficiency. Generally, it's quite mild in the winter in Texas. And so many of the homes, particularly in those big cities, don't have very efficient heating systems. They have a lot of resistive baseboard heating. They don't necessarily invest a lot in efficiency, in insulation and things like that. And where they do, it's mostly focused on the typical summer peak, because it certainly gets hot in Texas. And so the focus is often on making sure that you're not spending too much on air conditioning in the summer, not necessarily on heating in the winter. And so what that meant is the demand in Texas is very responsive when it gets cold. It goes way up really quickly. And so that was the first instigator of the crisis. There were record levels of demand for the winter set. And this is a system that primarily plans for a summer peak, not a winter peak. The second major crisis is that a large portion, at some points about 35% of the supposedly reliable firm generators in the state, mostly the natural gas power plants, but also some coal and one nuclear reactor, failed at the same time period and for many days, not just for an hour or two. And those failures were, you know, really two sources. One was, you know, frozen equipment. Again, you know, these are generally warm climates. They're focused on the summer peak. And so a lot of equipment that would normally be inside in a well-insulated environment in a colder place was outside or in a very, you know, poorly insulated building. And so it got really cold, and valves and critical measure, you know, meters and things like that. That's, I think, ultimately what knocked out the nuclear plant was a flow meter that they needed to have to know that there was enough coolant going. wasn't working because it froze, and you know the coolant was still going, but they had to make sure. And you can't run a nuclear plant if you don't know. And so they had to shut down for precautionary reasons. And you had gas plants, many gas plants also fail for equipment. And then the other big source of correlation is that Texas is a big gas producing region out in the Permian Basin and elsewhere. And because of that, it has very little gas storage. It relies on just-in-time delivery from the pipe, you know, from the wells into the pipeline system for what it needs. And the development in the Permian Basin has involved a lot of gathering lines that sit right on the surface, where again, if you were up in North Dakota, you would have buried those lines or insulated them to prevent, you know, freeze-ups in the winter. But in Texas, they didn't focus on that. And so, you know, there's a little bit of liquid and condensate in those lines, and they can freeze up. And when they do, they can block up compressors and damage equipment. And so much of the gas production also went offline. At some point, about 40%, I believe, of the overall Permian production was shut off because of frozen equipment. And that meant that pipeline deliveries also plummeted because it's sort of a just-in-time system. And there were, compounding on that, once they started blackouts, some of the compressor stations that were supposed to be on a critical equipment list and not blacked out ended up part of the rolling blackouts. And so they were knocked out, and that further reduced the gas delivery. So you have these sort of cascading failures. Some people do heat with gas, and gas delivery is prioritized to heating customers before electricity. So a lot of natural gas power plants also lost their gas supply, right, as they needed it the most. So this is an example of a, you know, not unprecedented, but not common, you know, extreme tail of the distribution of weather outcomes hitting a place. In other places, it could be extreme tails on the hot side or rainfall, right? You know, very rapid flooding and rainfall. And what we know about infrastructure systems is that they're resilient up to a point. And it's those extremes that really test the reliability and resilience of our systems. And you push something 1% further and it's fine, and 1% further and it's fine, but then 1% further and the whole system crashes, right? And you get these correlated failures that take out not 1% or 2% of your system, but a third of it, right? And there is no way you can do rolling blackouts to manage a reduction of, you know, a third of your supply. And so what happened was prolonged blackouts across major population centers. People froze to death. People died of carbon monoxide poisoning trying to heat their homes with their stoves or gas stoves or with their camp stove or whatever, or you know, their cars in their garages. And you know, we don't know exactly how many people, but it was, you know, dozens, if not more than 100, died due to the blackout. And billions of dollars of damages to homes and buildings occurred when, again, poorly insulated pipes for water in many homes froze. And then when it got warm again, thawed out and cracked, and major flooding damage occurred. So just a huge widespread, you know, set of damages. And it shows you again why, you know, power system reliability is so critical, but also how intertwined it is with other systems like our water system, like our gas delivery system, and how these failures can be correlated across all of those critical infrastructure if we're not careful. I would say, you know, the renewables, there was some wind farms that froze up as well. And, you know, again, if they were in North Dakota, they would have invested in de-icing systems that heat the blades. There they did not. And so some of the capacity was offline, but that was a fraction of the overall. And, you know, I mentioned earlier, we use wind and solar as fuel saving technologies, not as critical capacity that we need, you know, to be there when we need it. So what I told Congress when I testified on this was, you know, was that these are technologies that are reliably unreliable. We know that we're not supposed to depend on them, and so do grid planners. And so they're heavily discounted in terms of what we count. In fact, the grid planner counts on nothing from solar and only maybe 6% of the overall installed wind capacity to help during these sorts of periods. And for most of the period, they were overperforming that. What really was critical for the grid is that the technologies that we should have had counted on as firm, the ones we needed to be reliable, were unreliable exactly at the wrong time. And that's when people die. That's when, you know, when grids go down. And so it does call into question, you know, are these firm resources really firm? Are we really weatherizing and preparing for the kinds of extreme events that will test the reliability of our system? And in Texas, the answer is no. And unfortunately, I think it's still no. They've done very little in the intervening year, other than politicize the topic and use it to score points for Governor Abbott and others. You know, and it's really not a encouraging response to an unprecedented crisis. And so they're now going through heat waves in May and June that are setting new demand records, and you know, similar stresses happening on the grid now. And I don't know that they're much better prepared than they were a little over a year ago. So that's quite unfortunate. And if I were a Texan, I'd be pretty furious about it.
Is that going to have to change? You said the regulators they're not waiting for solar at all. Like they don't rely on it. That's going to have to change, surely, in a 100% renewable energy.
No, not necessarily. Again, that you'll count on them to produce a lot of the energy you need throughout the year, and that's where you get your value. And that, you know, means you don't have to burn natural gas and coal, and you don't need CO2 emissions. You know, you're saving on fuel costs because the average cost of electricity from wind and solar is far lower than the alternatives. But during those times when you really need reliable capacity, we're going to have to depend on firm resources and some degree on energy storage, but only for shorter duration periods. And so, you know, if you had a week-long crisis like this and a zero-carbon grid, you're going to really depend on clean, firm generating capacity to be there when you need it, demand flexibility to help level out that peak load, and batteries to help, you know, with the intradaily, you know, kind of cycles to, as much as you can. But you're not going to have a battery that's going to run for 5 days necessarily. We may see very long-duration energy storage technologies come to market alongside some of these clean, firm options in the future. Again, they're in that sort of early demonstration stage. You're going to depend on technologies like that, either very long duration storage or you know, hydrogen generators or nuclear power plants or geothermal to get you through those kinds of really challenging periods. Mm. And we're going to have to make sure that they're as weatherized and resilient to those crises as we need them to be. Otherwise, they really won't be firm. So I do think it's a warning sign that we need to, you know, question the reliability of even our most reliable assets and make sure that they're prepared for the changing climate extremes that we're facing. It's debatable how much the cold snap in Texas was related to climate change. There's arguments that it was because polar heating is weakening the polar vortex, which is the sort of currents that keep the cold up in the north generally. And when those break down, that you get these excursions of cold air across the center of North America, and they can extend as far south as Texas. So there's an argument that this was a climate-related exacerbated issue. Mm. But even if it wasn't, it's a good example of the types of extreme weather events that we know are driven by climate change, like flooding, wildfires, and extreme heat that are going to test the reliability and the metal of our systems going forward.
As well as looking in research in the US energy market, you obviously must be watching the European energy crisis quite closely. When you look at Europe from the US, what do you make of Europe's approach to the energy transition? Do you see any similar challenges to implementation? And where are the differences in terms of approach?
I think that there's a lot of similarities, but I think Europe has a bit more focus. And I think that's driven, you know, by slightly more functional democracies in many cases, right? I mean, much more functional democracies in some cases than the United States. So the ability to rally, you know, more sustained policy over the last decade and beyond, versus the United States, which has been quite sporadic at the national level. Also, you know, the United States is blessed with an abundance of fossil resources, and that's been an asset, particularly at times of geopolitical or geosecurity crises like now. To have, you know, to be energy self-sufficient is an asset that can be used, for geopolitical purposes and other security reasons. But it also means we've had much lower cost natural gas than Europe, much lower cost oil in many cases. That's a policy choice in many cases due to tax differences. And so that's been, there's less consumer focus on the transition, I think, than there has been in Europe historically. I think the real test is how Europe and the United States respond to the current energy crisis fueled by the war in Ukraine. And there, I think it's very likely, unfortunately, that the countries could diverge, although I'm doing everything I can to encourage US policymakers to double down on the energy transition as well, because it is the most effective way to improve our energy security. I think it's pretty clear that Europe is going to, while in the short term, rely more potentially on coal power to displace gas or, sign new LNG deals, that is a, you know, a short-term effort to change the bridge, right? The bridge was supposed to be Russian gas in many cases, right? And now the bridge is going to have to look different, but to accelerate the transition across the bridge towards, reductions in overall dependence on fossil fuels. So you see that in the Repower EU plan, you see that in national responses in the UK, and in Germany and France and elsewhere, really doubling down on the things that will not just provide alternative supplies of fossil fuels, which is maybe important in the medium and near term, but to dramatically reduce the amount of natural gas and oil that have to be consumed in the economy. I think if you look at the United States right now, and I wrote an op-ed in the New York Times about this recently, it really shows the limits of the energy security, energy independence framework that has governed a lot of US policy, and particularly the politics of the Republican Party for, at least the last decade. In 2008, when John McCain and Barack Obama were contesting the presidential election, we had the last oil price and gas price spike. All of a sudden, energy prices and costs were a big topic in the presidential debate. And we had the birth of the sort of drill baby drill chants on the right, from Sarah Palin and others who popularized this idea. Well, the only thing the United States needs to do is to unleash, U.S. fossil fuel production. That'll quench energy prices and secure our economy. We did that largely, even as Barack Obama and Democrats invested in renewable energy and drove down the cost of wind and solar by 70 to 90%. We also had a dramatic revolution from shale oil and gas that took the United States from the largest importer of oil in the world to a net exporter of oil and refined products in the last decade. That's a remarkable transition. And the promise was that would secure our economy and our country from oil crises. And I think if you look around right now, you can see the limits of that approach, right? We have a full-on crisis in the United States as well. Inflation is predominantly driven by energy price spikes. If you look at the basket of goods that are driving inflation in the United States and in Europe, we have $6, $7 a gallon gasoline in California. It was $3.50, $3.50, in January. We have natural gas prices that we've not seen since 2008. What's happening is that even though we are energy self-sufficient, which is certainly good from a security perspective, our economy is just as hooked on these global commodities and just as vulnerable to global price spikes as they were, in 2008. And so, the whims of a dictator or autocrat on the other side of the world can send a ripple or shockwave across the global economy and strike at consumers in the United States or in Europe overnight and drive, the cost of commuting and the cost of doing business for, companies through the roof. And there's nothing we can do about that by drilling more. It will not solve those problems. It might help Europe diversify its energy supplies as an exporter to our allies, right, for security reasons, but it will not secure our economy and our households and our businesses from the vulnerability to oil price and gas price spikes. And so the only thing that will is the kind of stuff that we were already talking about in terms of the energy transition, right? Reducing our consumption of these fuels so that the next time a price spike happens, we are much less vulnerable. That actually has already happened to a degree. If you look at the improvements in energy fuel efficiency of our fleet relative to 2008, while gas prices at the pump are starting to get back up to inflation-adjusted records, the actual bill that you pay when you fill up your vehicle is still quite a bit lower than it would have been in 2008 under the same kind of prices because we've improved the efficiency of the fleet. Now, if you could get electric vehicles out to the millions of customers who want them over the next decade, that will dramatically insulate our economy from these kinds of spikes. If you can switch to heat pumps for buildings, you can improve the efficiency of our industries so they rely less on these fuels. All of that will substantially improve our economy and our businesses' resilience to these sorts of shocks. And it's really the only thing that will work. And so fortunately, that also helps accelerate the clean energy transition. We need to tackle climate change. There's a perception that energy security and climate change are at opposing ends. And that's really, at least in the medium and long term, not at all the case. And I think the test will be to see how much foresight countries have as they respond to this near-term crisis.
Yeah, we need to stop drilling for more and start using less. I think that's such an important point. And I totally see in the short term, you know, when there's a real constraint on supplies, then you got to diversify supply to some extent. But in the long term, I think you're absolutely right, Jesse. It is about accelerating the transition away and making sure we no longer depend to such an extent on fossil fuels, which are traded globally, and they're always going to be volatile, those prices, to some extent or another.
I know that some folks have raised the idea that we'll just be switching our dependence on, you know, fossil fuels for dependence on rare earth metals or lithium or other commodities like that. There is some truth to that. We'll need to make sure that we have secure supply chains that can scale with our needs. But it's a very different kind of challenge, because that goes into the new infrastructure we're building, not the stuff that's already out there. So whatever we've deployed, the wind farms that are operating, the electric vehicles that we're driving, the next time the crisis happens, they will be fully insulated from any kinds of commodity cycles, right? It's, you're driving your car already. You don't need to buy more lithium to run your electric vehicle. So it's a different kind of challenge. And I think many who are trying to slow down the energy transition are raising this as a red herring to try to make, you know, people just as afraid of, you know, lithium commodity cycles as they are of oil and gas. They're really not the same thing, and they do not have the same scale of consumption at all. You know, it's orders of magnitude. The amount of oil we dig up and move around and burn across the world every year, every day, is a staggering amount. On nearly 100 million barrels of oil a day, you know, we're not consuming anywhere near that much lithium or cobalt or other things like that. So it is a challenge, one we should definitely be proactive about, but not at all a reason to slow down the energy transition or to undermine the benefits of that kind of transition.
Just a final question on that. Is there anything that the US can learn from Europe's approach to getting off gas and getting off Russian gas? Is there anything that America can learn from that in its own backyard?
Well, I think we've already talked about the kinds of accelerated measures that the Netherlands is taking to switch off of gas heating. We've seen electric vehicle adoption rates go through the roof across European countries. You know, I think in the UK, in the first quarter, it was over 20% of vehicles sold were electric or plug-in. And that was up from, that's like double the last, you know, the quarter of the year before. And so if we can, you know, see the same kind of focused on the demand side of the transition and on clean electricity, because we do consume a large amount of gas in power generation. And so we can not only reduce consumption on the household and, you know, transportation business side, but also by diversifying our power sector. And we're seeing Europe do all of that, right, as a way to get off of Russian gas. Again, yeah, I think in the near term, the next couple of winters, Europe will need to burn more coal as well to quickly get off of gas in the power sector. But that's going to be a short term, you know, couple of winter cycle. And by the end of, winter of 2023, 2024, I think Europe could basically be off of gas and coal in the power sector, or off of gas and back to current levels of coal consumption in the power sector by the end of the second winter, you know, coming up, by accelerating the deployment of renewable energy and improving end use efficiency and electrification. I mean, that would basically be accelerating the transition that was already underway, but shortening the timescales. And it's kind of remarkable to see, you know, what a war will do for people's perception of what's possible. I think when the war began, there were many, a very serious person that quickly, you know, pontificated that it would take decades to free Europe from Russian fossil fuels and that they'd never, you know, be able to do it. And now, you know, we're looking at a 90% reduction in oil imports by this year, an elimination of coal imports, and hopefully, I think, a complete elimination of natural gas by the winter as well. I know that's not the current EU strategy. Reduce consumption by about 2/3 by this year and get off it entirely by 2027 or 2030. I think that through a variety of additional measures, we've done analysis in our group here that complement the Repower EU plan, including a greater reliance on in the short term on coal to quickly reduce gas consumption and power, and a recalibration of storage targets to reflect the reduced consumption that is likely over the next couple of years. You don't need to store as much gas this winter as you did last winter if gas demand in Europe is down substantially. that it would actually be feasible for Europe to get entirely off of Russian gas this year. We started this analysis right after the war began because we knew that natural gas would be the principal challenge for Europe to transition away from, given the reliance on pipelines to import so much from Europe. And we also knew that it'd be the most potent economic lever that the West would have on Russia as well to reduce their revenues that are currently flooding in you know tens of billions of euros a month to Russia that's fueling you know both sides of the war, unfortunately. So we've completed analysis of both the power sector and the gas networks in Europe to make sure these strategies are feasible. And there's a few different combinations of you know demand side measures of fuel switching to gas from gas to coal. And energy efficiency improvements that can get Europe all the way to you know independence from Russian gas this year if the demand is there, if the necessity is there.
Jesse, thank you. I'm sure we could speak for much longer on the various differences between the EU and America and the barriers America is facing. Just before we go, I'd like you to look into your crystal ball and just tell us what you see in 10 to 20, maybe 30 years time, what the energy spectrum looks like, what the energy mix looks like.
So I think that really, you know, 10 or so years, 10 to 15 years from now, I mean, I have a 4.5-year-old son. And so I think about like when he gets his license at 16 in the US, right, to drive, you know, he won't call the vehicles at the lot electric vehicles. They'll just be vehicles. They'll just be cars and trucks, right? Because they'll all be electric, I think, at that point. You know, and they'll be the classic cars rolling around the, you know, the classic 2010, you know, Chevy Camaro or something running on gasoline, right? That people are excited to see every once in a while as an exotic vehicle. But I think the electric, the transition of mobility to electric vehicles is going to progress much more rapidly than many people, you know, thought was possible, including myself a few years ago. And we're at this really fundamental tipping point now where the whole automotive sector is really kind of recognizing that electric is the future. And once the capital starts to flow there, as it is for these companies, you know, it's really going to snowball. And so I think, you know, really we tend to underestimate dramatically, with these sorts of exponential trends, we tend to maybe overestimate what's possible in the short term and then dramatically underestimate what's going to happen in the long term. And I think this is a good example of that really over that 10 to 15 year period. You know, I think we're going to go to, you know, pretty much full electrification of new sales. So that'll take time to roll over into the fleet. I also hope that we are really, you know, seeing the majority of our electricity coming from renewable energy, from wind and solar, by that sort of 2030, 2035 timeframe. And that we're grappling with these challenges around how to go further, right? How to deal with the social license to build more infrastructure, to expand transmission, to tap offshore wind, and how to scale up the new clean, firm power technologies that we need to deliver the rest of the emissions reductions. And so I think that's where we could easily be headed. And, you know, I think we need a policy push to make sure that the odds of getting there are as high as possible. But I'm confident that's the direction that we're headed.
That's great. Before we go then, we ask all of our, we go around the table and ask what caught my eye in the last week or so. Jan, what caught your eye?
Well, actually an old report from the IEA on the future of cooling, which is absolutely fascinating. I mean, I read it in the context of the heat waves we had in Europe last week and still ongoing to some extent, with temperatures being 40, 45 degrees centigrade in some areas or even more. And I've been interested in this for a long time because you know, if we get more heat waves, extended heat waves, the demand for air conditioning will go up. It's already going up. And we know from the US experience and also from European localized examples that you can get sudden spikes in electricity demand because of you know, additional air conditioning. So super interesting report that looks at kind of where air conditioning systems are being used, in which countries and why, the history of that, and also where it's going to be maybe by 2050. And it's highly recommended if you're interested in the impact of heat waves on electricity demand. That's a really good report.
That looks really interesting. Obviously, yeah, with global warming, everything, you know, cooling is going to become much more of an issue. Absolutely. And especially in, I always find it interesting how we're going to do it with these buildings that were built for colder climates and how they are going to adapt to a a warmer environment. Jesse, how about you? What caught your eye?
Well, so I just got back from the first ever in-person macro energy systems workshop at Stanford in Palo Alto, California. This is a relatively new effort to pull together the research community around, you know, macro scale energy systems research, the kind of stuff that underpins much of our analysis of energy transitions. And an area that is really, you know, because of its nature, inherently interdisciplinary and spread out across a variety of, you know, sort of academic homes, different departments, different journals, different conferences people go to, different ways in which they conduct their research. And so to kind of create a center of gravity for all of that, I've been part of the steering committee for the macro energy systems community since 2020. We've been really trying to bring together a new kind of center of gravity for that research community. We had an initial workshop it was supposed to be in summer of 2020, and of course wasn't in person. We ended up going virtual. And so this is the first time we've been able to gather in person. It was a wonderful 2-day workshop, right? I stressed the work part of the workshop. We really saw some really excellent presentations, but also got to work thinking about the future of the field and the community and how we can bring this together further. And so just really delighted to see that come together and to see my colleagues in person and to hear about the really important, you know, work that they're doing on energy transitions and equity and decarbonization and technological innovation and, you know, dealing with the social opposition to new, you know, technology deployment and infrastructure, all the kinds of challenges we've been talking about here. So if you're interested in that realm and you're a researcher or a research adjacent, the consumer of this research, check out macroenergysystems.org. And, you know, we're growing the community. So the more the merrier.
Perfect. Yeah, absolutely. We can put a link to that in the show notes as well. For me, it's going to look a little bit dodgy, but it's actually, yeah, and I've been playing with the new wrap blueprint that was released, I think, earlier this week or late last week, the power system blueprint, and how, you know, wrap put together all of these sort of ideas and a pathway to a clean and renewables based grid. So I've been playing around with that. It's a really interesting sort of user experience. As you go into the blueprint, you can click on the various different parts of the energy system that you want to learn more about, just seeing where RAP sees the pathway to a net zero economy. And I think it's such an interesting tool to have.
Thanks for the free advert, David. Much appreciated. No, it's a great tool. We're gonna update it over time and make it better. And we're looking for feedback, and it's not like what Jesse's doing, because of technical modeling. We kind of take that as a given, but we're looking at if you want to call it regulatory modeling, like where do we need to be by 2035 with regulation, with market design, with all these different policies to meet those really ambitious scenarios that people like Jesse have been modeling for years. How do we actually get there from a sort of regulatory point of view? So please do provide us with feedback. You can do that on Twitter or by email. There's a blueprint email address, I believe, on the website. We would love to hear what you're thinking and incorporate any feedback, really.
Definitely, we can do that as well. And I say it's just great the way it's laid out, you can see how it's all interconnected as well. So I think that's just really fascinating, really useful tool to have. My thanks to Jesse, to Jan, and to our producer, Anna. That's all of the time we have today. If you have any thoughts or questions of anything we said on today's podcast, you can reach us on our Twitter accounts. I'm on @DaveW_Foresight. Jesse?
I'm at Jesse Jenkins. That's J-E-S-S-E, Jesse. Very active on Twitter. So see you there.
Jan?
Jan Rosenau. All one word.
You can also tweet the show @WhatMattersPod or email us show@WhatMattersPodcast.com. Thank you all so much for listening, and we'll see you again very soon.